Good evening, everyone. This is Veronica Entwistle, and we have a very exciting paradigm shifter tonight. He was our very first paradigm shifter back in 2007. Oh, those were the days. And it's Randy Masters who's going to talk to you about geometric shapes and sound and color and anything else we've decided to talk about, because Randy has been exploring sacred geometrics for a long, long time. He's also a musical composer. He studies the effect of sound on people. But I think tonight we're going to talk to you more about geometrics, maybe. So welcome to the show, Randy Masters.
Thank you, Veronica. Yes, indeed.
So are you a shape shifter?
And shapes is, you know, we'll be helping people get, you know, geometrically fit here.
Oh, are you a shapeshifter?
Yeah, in this kind of way. Not like on Star Trek, to my knowledge, you know.
So what on earth does it mean? We're going to talk about geometrics, and I know that you can talk about them in a very erudite way, but right now we're going to say, what on earth does it mean to the average person or to the seeking person to begin to understand geometrics?
Well, you know, a lot of people had geometry in school, and a lot of people like that, even though for the
I
most
loved
part,
it in school, actually.
Pardon me?
I loved it in school.
Well, I did too. I was the top geometry student in the school, and I just excelled at it. And it was like, you know, maybe sophomore or junior year, one of those. And then I didn't really think too much of it after that, because I really went on, when I went on to college, I was just totally way deep in music, and it was wall-to-wall music, plus all the other basic studies. So I pretty much let go of the geometry world for a long time. And then when I met Drumvalo, I took maybe, perhaps, I guess it was might have been his third class or so, mm-hmm. when he first started teaching on a trip to New Mexico. He was living there, and we met, and he thought I was the person, after meeting me, to put together the relationships between sacred geometry and music. So I had started to open up into that field, and then that whole meeting just slam dunked me way big into the sacred geometry, and I found that that is a big part of my calling along with the music. So I spent several years, a lot of years, diving really deep down the rabbit hole in sacred geometry, working to have the geometry knowledge catch up with my music knowledge so that I was really fluent and versed. And it was really a passion. I mean, I would stay up all night doing different things, which he did too when he was getting stuff from Toth or Tahuti. And it happens to a lot of people.
He channeled Toth, didn't he?
Well, not really. Toth would appear and just show up in the room. You could see him and sit down and talk to him, and then he would just kind of walk through a wall or disappear.
Oh, we like that, hey?
Yeah, pretty wild stuff.
Well, now, just before we go too much farther, can you give people a link between something that we can understand between geometrics and music, something that can be a bridge from one to the other?
Well, as far as that part, it's really all about sacred relationships and sacred proportions. The proportions in a musical composition of however many measures and however many sections and how long the sections and measures are and the number of notes and phrases and the intervals, the distance from one note up to or down to another note.
So they're kind of spaces in sound in a way, aren't
they? Yeah. So you can completely, you could take the blueprint of a temple and translate all of the proportions of that temple into a musical composition.
Wow. Have you ever done that?
And there was a lot of that type of thing in the Renaissance period of time, where a lot of the composers applied aspects of music, and a lot of the architects used musical proportions in the physical structure of Gothic cathedrals and other temples and other kinds of sacred, you might say, and I don't mean religious all the time every time I say the word sacred, and I'll come back to that and clarify that aspect. So one place you see it is in the arches. So like if you did a 3/5 arch, you would take a line and divide it into 5 sections and then move like the compass over from the left to the right over 3 and swing an arc. Then you take it from the other edge and you move it over 3 and swing an arc up, three evenly spaced spaces going to the left, and you swing an arc, and all of a sudden now you have an arch, and that would be a 3/5 arch.
Oh.
That's how that's created. You do it all with a compass. You don't even have to measure anything. And then, you incorporate that in the building. So lots of buildings, especially, different churches and around Europe and so on, and certainly in Iran and Iraq and those areas of Persia, the whole Mesopotamian era and area was based on these musical proportions built into the architecture.
Now tell me this, is it also good, is that very key, not playing on words here, to the acoustics in these buildings?
Well, yes, it's part of it. It's part of it. And the building material and where the building is situated, that has to do with geomancy and also with ley lines and earth grids, exactly where it's placed and how the the meridians of the earth are flowing, and where they place the church or the temple on those lines or near those lines or around them, and all of the variations that I just mentioned, so that those energies flowing in those circuits in the earth are amplified and broadcast by the temple. And that's a very key.
And when you say broadcast, it means that they are emanating a sound? They're actually emanating a sound?
Yeah, they're emanating energies and vibrations, and whether or not it's something that people hear. I mean, it doesn't mean it's not a sound if it's too high or too low for you to hear it. Do you follow me?
Yes, I do. It's like the frequencies are moving, and some of them we can pick up with our receivers, and some we can't.
Yeah, so Alexander Putney wrote a book called Phi, P-H-I, where he had about 127 different sacred sites around the world and mapped them and showed how there's different scientific measurements that have done that show the waves that come off of these sacred sites and how they permeate the world and what it looks like superimposed on maps of the world, all in color and extremely beautiful book.
And did he show Well, you could probably explain this better than I can, but aren't they all connected in terms of invigorating energy around the world? Aren't they a part of
it? Well, they are, and one of the things he's mentioning is that they're sending out 1.45 hertz, which is way down in delta. That note would be called a G-flat, by the way.
All right.
If I remember right, it's a G-flat rather than an F-sharp. But anyway, it's in that zone. There's technical reasons of what you'd call it. I mean, if that were 1.45 hertz, which it is, and of course that's really low, way down at the bottom of, even elephants have been noted to be way down in the bottom of delta. So all these sacred sites that they're finding are sending out this pulse, this low subsonic of 1.45 hertz. So they're linked up by that exact frequency.
But is that because of the buildings or just because of the earth right there?
That's because of the way the temple as a sacred, harmonic, geomantic structure is how it's built, where it's placed, and how it's put into the grid in such a way that these temples are designed to talk to each other. So that's like the fundamental frequency to tune into the channel, you might say, like on the Earth's broadcasting radio station, mm-hmm. that all these sacred sites talk to each other through that frequency.
And what are they saying?
Different things, I would think, depending on their location, who built them, what part in time, what era, what star systems may have been involved in guiding the building.
Are they sending out messages to the star systems? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And receiving, they're transceivers.
Okay, that's really interesting.
So
isn't it?
Yeah. They're designed to receive frequencies from the cosmos. Combine that with the Earth energy. Some are designed to bring the cosmic light from different stars and such and planets into the Earth and create a certain kind of a rapport and dialogue, a conversation, you might say, or some kind of a communication that's important for the integrity of the whole working music of the sphere system.
Uh-huh.
Now, in that case, I'm talking about the celestial mechanics, not just planets, moons, planets, star systems, and those. And when you build, the ancients built a lot of these sites, part of anchoring the energies to make that site auspicious and functional for whatever their intentions are, is to anchor the starlight and the energies from different star systems. So then when you see, for instance, in the Giza Pyramid, all these shafts that come into the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber, and they're aligned so that at certain times of year, light from certain stars goes down that shaft at a specific date and a specific alignment. So part of the building of these sacred structures is that they resonate dimensionally, and they resonate also with the energies from different stars and bring that star knowledge as light, specifically as light. And Ted Denmark, a number of years ago, was teaching at one of the colleges up in California, like Sonoma, somewhere like that. He was teaching computer things, and he had computer classes and such, and he had a big telescope. So he started aiming that telescope at specific stars, and as the light came through the telescope, he had a stock bottle of, I think, probably distilled water, and I don't know what else he might have put in it at that time, and it collected the starlight, and then that turned into a big project called the Starlight Elixirs. There's the book out that John Fox channeled by Fred Rubenfeld and Michael Smulkis called Starlight Elixirs. It's, you know, like an inch to inch and a half thick book of knowledge about all these star systems and what it is to tune into the light from those star systems.
And what is it?
What is what?
I mean,
in a thumbnail.
No, I'm being a bit cheeky, but when you take an elixir with a certain star effect, what kind of effects could people get? Healing, wisdom, heart opening.
Yeah, they could all of a sudden embrace a possibly deeper connection to that star system in their cells.
So they could kind of wake up?
It's like taking a special homeopathic. That water, structured by starlight from a specific star system, could encode the water throughout their whole body, like, you know, the liquid crystal aspect. And all of a sudden, their body is able to receive messages, however that is for that person, whether it's images or frequencies or visions or telepathy or something from that star system, or open up to contribution from that star system into their transceiver that they are as a human being.
Oh, so that's really wonderful. So have you...
they become a temple, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like having special shafts that, you know, except it would be not just a certain time of the year. It could be any time. And I've used those in workshops where we work with these starlight elixirs, and very fascinating.
So I guess then we become like sacred geometric sites at that point, do we?
Yes. And as our own temple, and as a more attuned temple, I believe our bodies are designed to be ultimate ascension temples. And that's what's been kept from people. It's just how fascinating the human body designed by the Creator is and what we can do. And I think that's why a lot of extraterrestrials and beings are very interested in what humans do, because we have been engineered to be whole and complete ascension temples. And sacred geometry and geometry, which I'll clarify all those terms, those things are all about using shape and resonant buildings and resonant shapes and frequency through proportion and building material and size and acoustics and all of that stuff to influence our field. So it's a field effect that happens both two-dimensionally from looking at pictures, three-dimensionally from playing with physical objects that are made in these proportions, and also multidimensionally beyond the third dimension, because that's the higher level that the real adepts put into the temples, way beyond the third dimension.
So let's jump to the pyramids, which I know you're quite a master of those, aren't you, in the sense that you've gone there a number of times and you lead tours there and you help people understand about the relationship of angles and so on and the
power. Yeah, and did we answer that question? The first question you had, I started kind of giving some background on it about, I'm trying to remember if it was exactly how you worded it, about what is the deal with geometry or why is that? And then we mentioned about, you know, people in school started getting geometry.
Yeah, I just asked basically what is sacred geometry,
okay,
and how
I think
can
I should define
it?
That.
Okay, you're on.
Because it'll feed into the rest of what we get into.
Perfect.
Basically what geometry means is to measure the earth.
Okay.
Geo for the earth and metri for metrics and measure the earth. Well, that is unfortunately not a complete term, because when you look at the music of the spheres and the sacred geometry of the fabric of space-time, that's the sacred geometry of and the sacred ratios. And by sacred here, I mean what the Creator uses to create with. I don't mean religious.
Okay.
Even though churches and temples and synagogues and mosques and Buddhas and stupas and all of these different kinds of things are made that can be associated with philosophies and religions. I'm talking about human beings or human beings with the assistance of non-earth-based beings being guided to pay attention to the patterns that the Creator uses. Now, when we say Creator, now we're talking about the Creator of everything, and then stepping down to other beings who are like the overseers of different planets and those who oversee the earth, for instance, which some say, you know, there's different kinds of teachers and beings who are responsible for our solar system and responsible for overseeing the development of the earth and so on. So often those beings were called gods, you know, whether it's a capital G or a small g, you know, creative beings that are part of the total creative force, but step down from the Creator of all it is, who even created these beings.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a directive. So different beings, like Yahweh, they say, I mean, that's not really the pronunciation. Excuse me on that. You have to tone it, to sing it, to pronounce it. You can't really say it. But anyway, that was responsible for overseeing Earth. And maybe certain domains beyond the earth, but for sure, let's say the earth. And there's a book Reg T. Miller wrote called A Pyramid Truth, Gateway Universe. That's a fascinating book about the pyramids and the energies, and attributes it to Yahweh being the overall director of that whole project. And that doesn't exclude beings, you know, from other galaxies that they call travelers and so on. Saying that this one being did all the work, but somebody who has the great blueprint and downloads and brings in the team to do the work, whether it's light beings or physical beings and beings that travel from elsewhere and landed here and their footprints are here on the earth, that type of a thing.
So the work is actually to empower, whether it's a structure or humans, with the possibility of growing in higher consciousness, right?
Oh, absolutely. And all kinds of agendas for what these pyramids and other temples are tuned to. And today it's very popular to lump all that stuff into this realm called sacred geometry. And there's a lot of books that use the term sacred geometry. So when I'm saying sacred, and I'm not saying that all the authors who have written these books are clarifying it the way I am, I mean sacred meaning the creational patterns that the Creator and the creation forces use, that if you look under a microscope or a telescope all over the universe and down inside the sub worlds, you're going to see this geometry, these shapes. And I mean, there should be another word for sacred shapes, let's say, or creationally proportioned shapes, because I'm trying to take the geo out, because it's not only on Earth. For instance, if you look at all the minerals in the all plants, animals, creatures on Earth are created from, the minerals that are found on Earth, and you go down into the atomic structure of those minerals, there are 21 key shapes that fit into 7 different crystal kingdoms. And each crystal kingdom has got 3 expressions. So there's 21 shapes that all the whole periodic table of elements, subatomic lattice structure, is built on. So all form built out of stuff all has a sacred geometry that most people don't see unless they were to peer into the subatomic and notice that.
Is that the same in our cellular structure?
Absolutely. Everything we're made out of, all the cells, everything, whether we're a plant, an animal, fish, insect, mammal, doesn't matter. We all are made of the minerals from the earth, unless we're from somewhere else. And, you know, we're made of something else and we're visiting. If we're born here, that, in my understanding, is we share the earth's mineral kingdom in common in our makeup, and therefore we all have that in common. And so it's a bonding that all life forms have with each other. So you, and I remember that when most of the time when I'm encountering different creatures, to look at that creature and say, hey, you know, you have the same geometries in your atomic matrix as I do. So we ought to, maybe we can communicate and get along here. So I remember that when I'm talking to a fly or something. And but not necessarily if I'm running from a bear.
Do the flies answer you?
You know, and then the bear gets, oh, wow, there's nothing to be afraid of. This person is, you know, sees my geometry or whatever, right?
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of the St. Francis effect. At the subatomic structure, using sacred shapes, and I'm taking the word, well, here I can use geometry because we're talking about sacred shapes that are found on Earth for sure.
Right.
No matter what goes on anywhere else, these are minerals that are found on Earth.
But isn't it likely that even in other galactic centers, there would be similar structure?
Yes. And there could be some places that have minerals that we don't have, or a blend of the minerals, or some minerals that don't exist on Earth, or haven't been found yet, or haven't been created, but they will be created. And then once they are, it's kind of like they've been here. And most of the sacred geometry classes do not teach about this lattice structure. This comes out of crystallography. Glenn Lear, who is a being I've known for, you know, almost 30 years or so, who makes a lot of sacred geometry jewelry for me that I design, he teaches classes about the crystallography and this aspect. And it's almost like tarot cards, people holding these shapes get different communications as if you were to draw a card from a sacred card deck. Very, very, very interesting aspect that is not there in the books. At least in my library, you know, very few books have anything except, unless you go into crystallography. So I'm mentioning that because we all have this in common, whether we pay attention to it or we are not. We're built out of this material. So we can get with the program and become conscious participants, co-creators with all of this as we wake up to it, and that's part of why I teach about these things. So that's one aspect.
How can we be conscious of our lattice work? Does it require an intuitive entering into our fields?
And we could do meditations and go down into our cellular structure, like that fantastic Voyage movie where the being was shrunk down and injected into the body and went traveling through the human body.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, that's an example. Mm-hmm. Well, we can do that kind of traveling in meditations and go in and visit our body and look at things and see if something needs a tune-up. And that's another way to do healing at the subatomic lattice level.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say the atomic lattice level or both. So that's a big, big part of the sacred geometry. So I was starting there on the microcosm. And now I'll flip that from a microscope now into a telescope. And we look out at all these galaxies and look at the Hubble pictures and other ones that have been taken from the various space telescopes. And you see entire galaxies with different kinds of spirals and geometry and very specific kinds of spirals interpenetrating each other at times, or one will spin one way, a female galaxy and a male galaxy will spin the other, and sometimes they're magnetizing each other, and these two, one male and one female spin galaxy, are attracting and moving towards each other. So they're like twin flames in the sky at the level of a whole galaxy.
Hmm.
So, and then we have the geometry in the various kinds of orbits of the planets that can all be laid out using specific sacred geometry, especially, you know, in our solar system.
Because
very precisely. I have geometric diagrams of all of our planets laid out to 99.something% of every single planet and its orbit, and how those orbits patterns intersect with very, very specific geometric patterns in the sky.
Hmm. But are they geometric patterns that we can see, and what are they like? Are they like pyramids? Are they like Merkabas?
Well, we don't see them. They're moving as slow as they're moving, unless you know, kind of take a picture of a certain amount of the orbit.
Time release kind
of
thing.
Or orbit, because it's a vortex movement. It's orbiting and vortexing. So a friend of mine calls it vorbit. Anyway, that's the idea. And they're never in the same place at the same time, so it's not a Groundhog Day or a Groundhog Year or anything like that. We're never at the same place in the universe that we've been.
Hmm.
And that's really important. In other words, we're always progressing and moving to new places, as we are now in this specific alignment with the galactic center that the interpretations of the Mayan calendar are all referring to.
Well, one of the things that the Mayan, the people that I know that are studying the Mayan calendar and also are studying oneness blessings or the Diksha phenomenon, the whole thing about oneness is really big. It's also in the Vedas and so on. And I'm going, well, that oneness you're talking about where we're all sharing that lattice geometrics, I'm going, well, it's just another way of interpreting how we are all one at a certain level.
Yeah, we just have to lessen the resistance to the fact that that's already the truth. It's not something that needs to be created. It already exists.
Right.
And we can muck it up by ignoring it or pretending in illusion of separation that it doesn't exist.
Hmm.
And that's not true.
So jumping around a little bit, we're also, when we talk about geometrics, it often rings to me to be about proportions and so on. And humanity, we're all proportionately built in specific ratios, aren't we?
Yeah.
Our arms and...
And there's many books that have these diagrams, and hopefully we'll have time and I'll mention a bunch of wonderful books for sacred geometry that the listeners might be interested in studying or looking into. But there are pictures of statues and famous Greek statues, for instance, and Buddhas and things, and human bodies, male and female, that are all diagrammed out showing these proportions. The Power of Limits by Georges Doxy, that book is easily available. And it's full of diagrams of everything from butterflies and birds and airplanes and pagodas and dancers' bodies and on and on, showing all the sacred geometry of the bones and the structures and the proportions from one part to another, a completely analyzed and 100% sacred geometry, all the creatures, fish, insects, birds, everything. And that's what I'm saying in terms of the sacred part of shapes, is the fact that these sacred proportions that the Creator uses is built into all the Creator's creatures. Unless, you know, we get a certain kind of deformities that you might get, like, let's say, with a dwarf or something, where all of a sudden the head size and the body proportions are different. You know, all these phi golden mean ratios, the 1.618 to 1 ratio, the golden mean, the golden section, etc., and the phi ratio is built throughout all God's creatures, or all the Creator's creatures, if you like the word Creator better. And so when people see that, we can't try to make total enemies out of people, because, you know, somebody's tried to manipulate us with various kinds of beliefs and hatreds and all that nonsense that's going on in the world to stir up stuff. You look over there at somebody, even if you're looking through the sight of a rifle, and if you pay attention, you're going to see sacred geometry. And if you pay deeper attention, you're going to see that the person holding the rifle, for instance, has the same sacred geometry as the person that they're looking at as a target. Very interesting.
Back to oneness, eh?
Absolutely.
Well, let's jump into the pyramids, which is kind of an obvious place to go, right?
Yeah. They're spectacular and mysterious, because so many researchers have been trying to solve various puzzles, and then they run into walls with their own belief systems that sometimes they can't get beyond the point of view that they're coming from to discover a deeper reality that may pull the rug out from under their false sense of security that they've got it figured out.
Well, so talking about false sense of security, when were they built? Isn't there some huge discrepancies there, and who thinks they were built when?
Yeah, and it's very political. Yes. in terms of that, you know, and where archaeology was, and you know, the powers that be keep a very tight handle on artifacts and what different artifacts mean, and the dating of those, and reasons why they don't want something to now be a reveal that it was built maybe 10,000 years earlier than they think. So there's, you know, religious doctrines that don't want the pyramids to be built more than a couple thousand years ago, 3,000 years ago. And then there's belief systems that have been perpetuated through archaeology and university training, and belief systems through religious doctrines that people have made up and have their reasons why, for their point of view, it would be confronting to admit that something is older, and including things that are more advanced technologically that cannot be built by the best standards on Earth to this day. They cannot exceed it. They've tried. Japanese did an experiment to try to build a small model of the Giza Pyramid with this all kind of precision and things, and they weren't able to be really successful in doing everything there.
Well, is it because the effect? Okay, so if we go into the pyramids, is there not an extremely powerful effect because of the angles of the pyramids and so on? Is it not empowering?
Yeah, and angles bend light.
Okay.
And
sound.
Angles and angels, you know. Yeah. Angels as bringers of information and bringers of light. Well, you change the angle on something, and that's how you get the rainbow. It's a refraction angle, typically 41 point something, 42 degrees, up to about 43 something, is where you get the entire first rainbow, the first spectrum of the rainbow. And the angle in the pyramid of, you draw a diagonal through the base and then go up one of the edges, not up the middle of a face, but up one of the edges. And that angle, which you get down there at the corner where one of the edges comes down and meets the diagonal that goes through the base, that's called the Aries angle. And that is that 41 point something to 42 degree angle, which is that rainbow angle. Mm. Very interesting.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a lot of stuff about how the pyramids and when it had a capstone called the Benben stone gave off colors. And this Benben stone looked like kind of like a ram's horn inside of a half of an octahedron or a small version of the pyramid with this glowing serpent. And that's where a lot of the early serpent images came from, this aspect that's inside the capstone, the former capstone on the Giza pyramid, which was really famous through history as being a real phenomena and an inspiration. And it's, of course, not there now, wherever it really is. But, it, you know, and all kinds of light and colors came out of it, and people could see that. And there's documents that talk about all this color that came out. And also that color is light being bent through specific angles because of the way light and the geometries intersect with each other.
Hmm.
Like, you know, it's like a prism. You just take a prism out and let the sunlight come through it, and voila, there's the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Because of how it breaks down that spectrum through angles. If it wasn't for that right way of building the prism, you wouldn't get the rainbow spectrum that way.
Huh.
And so that's one aspect of how the pyramids work with light. That's not the only thing. So there's all kinds of different angles. The angles, for instance, another way that the angles are done is through the work of Rudolf Gantenbrink, who had this little robot called a Rupawat that he sent up through the shafts that they discovered in the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
They measured the angles of those shafts, and they're like 32.5 degrees and 39.5 degrees and 45 degrees. And you put all those angles together, superimpose them as longitudes and latitudes, linking up with Giza being the 0360 grid center of the entire Earth grid, which it used to be. Mm-hmm. Still is, but they shifted it over to Greenwich through the Navy in England, and, you know, 31 point such, et cetera, degrees away from Giza. But the real center of the Earth grid, where the maximum land mass equatorially and polar landmass is there right in the middle of the Giza pyramid. So,
is that legitimate to pick it up and move it to Greenwich?
No, it's not.
Okay, so we're not living in absolute
time. It's legitimate just the way the Gregorian calendar has a certain kind of legitimacy as it deviates from lunar cycles.
Hmm.
Right?
Yes.
It's off.
Hmm. And we live with that.
Yeah, as a dream spell that influences our thought and behavior and flow of things in life, because we're coming off of a false reference.
Aha! So let's go back.
You're never going to figure out the Earth grid if you don't center every bit of the whole grid for the entire Earth off of the Giza pyramid.
Huh, that's very interesting. There must be people doing that. I just
are lots of people. Carl Munk's work is all about the grid engineering, his longitude and latitude math. Carl Munk, M-U-N-C-K, he's an archaeocryptologist, he calls himself. Fantastic work of a certain aspect of, you might say, sacred geometry that has to do with what shape these temples are, where they are, and exactly what the longitude and latitude is. And there's a very specific math, and when you know how to work it, it's just like music. It's spectacular.
Hmm. And it tells you how they're all sending messages to one another, all these sacred sites and the...
Well, he doesn't delve into that so much. It's like Alexander Putney's work is revealing that and some others. But his is more about, you know, there's a common math, which is called grid math. And how does grid math work? Degrees times minutes times seconds will give you a number. And you divide and divide in these numbers into each other, and you get another number. And you look at how all this works, and it all answers to a set of constants that relate to things in physics and in the quantum world and into hydrogen and a whole bunch of things. all of a sudden you realize that these ancients were way, way advanced, not only in how they built the structure, but where they placed it and how they knew where to place it.
How they knew, yeah. But also the pyramids will do things like, or do we know what their original purpose is? We probably don't, but they do things like preserving or energetically preserving what, bodies?
Well, they can preserve it and destroy it because both sides of the equation are there with something like that. It's both volatile in a destructive way and auspicious in a creative way, and the destructive waves are called vertical negative green energies by Ibrahim Karim, and the health-giving, life-giving ones are referred to as horizontal negative green. He has a book called Back to a Future for Mankind, and it's a whole book on biogeometry that Ibrahim Karim, Ibrahim and Karim. He's an architect who lives in Cairo, and I've done work with him, some study, and I've been part of some research with him on some of the musical, I've been looking at some of the musical aspects of things that he's discovered, certain kinds of numbers that resonate with different qualities that were built into the sacred sites.
So, just one question here: if the frequencies or the way energy moves in a pyramid can both empower or destroy, isn't there also a connection between that and transcendence or transformation?
Yes, in the sense that you can create openings, you can help people process. As a process things, and certainly they had to go through initiations and processes to be able to withstand being in the pyramid at certain times during certain initiations. And as I understand, not everybody survived. Because there are certain places in the pyramids that if your fears come up, whatever you're afraid of, especially down in the pit underneath, at certain times, you know, you'll have a manifestation of what you're afraid of.
But isn't that mind-boggling? Is that not magical?
Yeah, absolutely. But it needs to be respected so that people don't fool around with it. Because the beings that built it were not fooling around. This is really serious stuff.
That's pretty powerful knowledge.
Some people did not get out with their life.
I've heard that.
Some people did, and they were changed.
But so it's actually being like a chamber of manifestation in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, and designed to also be initiation chambers to create ascended light beings out of the denser level of 3D and become stabilized in such a way that they could continue to stay in the third dimension and have that ascended consciousness and function here and not blow out the field. Because, you know, when Yeshua, one we call Jesus, after his resurrection says, "Don't touch me, I'm not in my earthly garment." You know, he had a light field that others weren't prepared to interact with. They weren't prepared for almost like approaching the Ark of the Covenant, the same kind of thing. Because they hadn't done the homework to interact with a field like that and not get their circuits blown out. So he had to do some things to become stable so that somebody could hug him and not get zapped.
Or completely destroyed, I suppose.
Yeah. So, you know, the pyramids are full of all of these different, and other sacred sites as well, not just the pyramids, but the pyramids are auspicious. And you asked about, well, do we know what they were used for? Lots of people know lots of things about what they were used for. Whether any one person knows all the things that they were used for is what I am interested in. But I have looked at a lot of what's been said, both channel material, scientific material, archaeological material, people who have been there and seen things and had experiences, and certainly there's a lot that the pyramids were intended to do. And the obelisks that went with them was part of the power stations. Those are like substations that beamed the energy out of the pyramid and sent it through the grid, and they had flying ships back in the earlier times that were all powered, and they had something like an electricity that was created by the pyramid, and the obelisk would send that energy. So their boats that worked on the oceans and their flying ships that they had operated off of that energy that tied in with the obelisks.
Wow.
So there's a number of people that know things about. There's a whole book on obelisks that doesn't get into the magic of what they really, really can do.
Hmm.
I was very disappointed. A very famous book on obelisks that really isn't saying the real stuff, in my opinion.
Well, I'd like to bring the pyramids home, if you know what I mean, is the art of creating structures. Not that I'm ignoring obelisks, but I don't want to waste our time with you here, stuff that we can't take home, because I know you can help us with that, because you live in a very resonant home, don't you?
Yeah, it's full of geometries and things, models all over the room. Every room in the house is tuned.
Right.
So, you know,
and it's amazing to be there, actually.
Well, hopefully it's, you know, very good for somebody who doesn't push them if they don't want to be pushed. You know, I've tried to do my best to tune it so that it's user-friendly based on free will, not something that, you know, people can't be in. And so I have hanging geometries. So when you hang geometries, you know, these resonant shapes are having an effect, even if they're just hanging from the ceiling or sitting somewhere. Now, if you put them in motion where they're rotating clockwise or counterclockwise, whatever speed, not so much about the speed, but the fact that they're turning, that, you know, like with a ceiling spinner, and you hook up a geometry, and it's revolving.
You mean a little pyramid or a spiral?
Yeah, exactly, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You get another effect. And then, so placing these around in the room, when you look at them, the way the sacred shapes and proportions in it will communicate to you is there's a recognition because you have these sacred shapes in your body. So there is an instant recognition at some level, whether it's conscious or just subconscious or unconscious or in the background. Nevertheless, it still goes on, and there's a type of resonance with a bigger field that's now affecting you. So people can tune their homes. Now, once they make models of the Giza Pyramid, little models like a foot edge length is not a big deal. Yeah, you can play with razor blades and food and do some stuff, but once you build it big enough to hang over your bed, then you have to be careful how you align it with the right faces and how you work with the magnetic north and things like that, because the larger those pyramids get, the more volatile the energies, and you want something that can help you regenerate in your sleep and good for meditation, not something that actually puts stress in the field because it's misaligned.
And is it the misalignment that creates the destruction? I mean, could you have one over your bed that created a destructive vibration?
Yeah, if you didn't align it right, it's a possibility of that.
Hmm.
The Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas, that's the way I was told, is there, for one thing, was supposed to have gold glass and this black glass claim, and they didn't send it back and make sure that they had the gold glass, so it's not covered in gold the way it was designed to be. And then something happened in the engineering, they cut a corner somewhere, and for a while I was told that a whole floor had to be shut down because of destructive things that were happening to people because they did not obey the proper blueprint instructions. And when you start building things that big, they can become more than just an auspicious figure, you know, temple. It can actually create disharmonics. And when they get big enough, they can also create standing waves that can affect the weather.
Ah.
And that's why medicine wheels do that.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can get attracted to different geometric shapes and put them in your home. You can hold them. You can hang them here and there and put them in auspicious places, which you can be more either intuitive or precise about or both. The Genesa crystal is something that's very good for conflict resolution to put up in a home or an office. It's made of four hoops, and when you get done with it, these four hoops interpenetrate each other if it's made correctly.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who make them who don't interpenetrate the hoops, and those are not made correctly, and I don't recommend those at all. But the ones that are made correctly, it's over, under, and when you look at it, you have so many curving triangles that have specific angles, these 60-degree angles, and then you have these curving like squares, but they're curved, so instead of 90-degree angles, you've got a whole bunch of these 120-degree angles. And all the angles have to be tuned right.
Hmm.
So to make one of these correctly is quite tedious. It takes quite a few hands. You can make one in less than an hour incorrectly, but it's not the same. GENESA stands for Genesis South America, part of a research project that was done a number of years ago. And the GENESA crystal models the way the heart works and all the different vortex mechanisms in the human heart actually works, is mirrored by that. The straight-edge version of a GENESA crystal is the shape called a cube octahedron. You cut the eight corners off of a cube at the halfway points on each edge, and you'll have these triangular areas on where the corners were, and then you'll have squares, and that's called a cube octahedron. That's a really important heart of the geometric flower of life, 3D flower of life grid. That's the shape that's in the heart of the whole matrix. And the curved version of it is the GENESA crystal. So you can hang that up in a room, and it can help resolve conflicts. It's very good to have in corporations and businesses and homes. If siblings are fighting or people, hang one of those up in the hallway, and a lot of times it'll help resolve conflicts because of the way the energy patterns work and the way it has people in the household link up with their own heart in a better way. So that's a very, very profound shape.
Well, spell that so we can look that up online.
GENESA.
Thank you.
Yeah, and there's a lot of information online about it.
So quickly, if we're playing around with geometric shapes for our household, can you tell intuitively if it's not right? Do you know if it's going to be destructive?
If you're in touch with your intuition, you can certainly tell if it's not right. You'll know where to place it, whether to place it exactly, and when to take it down and do and place it somewhere else, and all of the continuing upkeep of monitoring if where you put it is still the best place for the way the energies are flowing. We all have that ability to, but it may not be. It might not be activated. So, you know, some people will call in a feng shui type person. Not everybody in feng shui understands all of the different geometric shapes, but that's part of it. Geometry and sacred geometry came from the biogeometry and came out of the power of shape because shapes resonate. And that's where, you know, for instance, when people get out of sorts, they're bent out of shape, literally. You know, certain emotions cause distortions in their energy field, and that's what the bent out of shape means.
And for those of us who see energy, you actually see how it's distorted, don't you?
Yeah. And so if, in the organs in your body, if they get toxic enough and they maybe tumors grow on them or various things, or they swell or shrink or do whatever they do, they can all of a sudden become another shape. And that if that shape gets out of the blueprint of wellness, that's another version of bent out of shape.
So if you know something, someone, an organ or whatever is bent out of shape, you can vibrationally retune it so it comes back in shape?
Yeah, and connect with the original blueprint of optimal well-being that's right for an individual.
You can do that meditatively.
And make sure that the organ and the person's biofield and consciousness and field effect can accept having their field restored. That whatever resistances that they have going on that have caused it to get out of shape, they can work with that in such a way that the instruction sets that are held in the optimum blueprint realm outside of the physical body, in the aura and the Akashic field, and there are a lot of different terms for that. Basically their own personal quantum field, that field can accept the new instructions or the old instructions, in other words, the divinely proportioned, healthy instructions, and then it looks to that to say, how should I be shaped? And then you've got to get the resistances to being able to restore that shape, and that's part of the health in the body.
And is that what you do with tuning forks?
Tuning forks that are built on those ratios is part of that. Holding the geometric shapes, visualizing the geometric shapes, rotating them and spinning them activates the brain and the mind, and, you know, spinning different shapes in different parts of the body, holding the shape, intuitively setting it on different points, setting it on acupuncture points, and basically like getting an acupuncture treatment just with the geometric shape touching that part of the body or hovering above that part of the body and resonating and causing that part of the body to go into some type of preferred resonance with the shape.
And then that creates the healing. Well, Randy, I know you're giving a workshop soon. Would you like to tell us about it? Because you have more information than I can ever gather in an hour or two or a workshop. And I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, it'll be November 5th and 6th in Aptos. So people can contact me through my universalsong at yahoo.com email. Universalsong, S-O-N-G, at yahoo.com. And they can phone me at 831-662-2594, and either me or my answering machine will be on duty.
Well, this is
and it explores Egypt and the sacred geometry and sound and deeply and sounds and shapes and a bunch of things. And
so we can actually change our dimensional existence through using this kind of information, can't we, Randy?
Yeah. And these are all ways that we talk to the field and let the field talk to us through the bridge of sound, the bridge of shape, and the interaction of sound and shape working together.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll do it again.
Thank you. Yeah, this is big fun.
It is big fun. Thank you so much, Randy Masters, and thank you all for listening. This is Veronica Entwistle saying if you'd like any more information or suggest some other guests or would like a session with me, who is an intuitive, as you all know, or with Randy Masters, email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. Remember, no H in Entwistle. And thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed Randy as much as I did. Good night. Many blessings.